your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good afternoon. We want to welcome you all to our third case today and the last case on our calendar for March oral arguments. We have with us students from Wauwatosa East. Would they please stand? You may be seated. Thank you for coming. The students are here with a program that is sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. The program is called Court with Class, and we invite students from all around the state to come and join us for an oral argument. If they come, they're given materials about the case, and they may engage in some other activities relating to this case. They come, they listen to an oral argument, and they participate with a justice of the court at noon. And the discussion is about the procedures of the court in taking, hearing, and deciding cases. The substantive issues of the case are not discussed. And Wauwatosa East joined with students from Monticello High School and met with Justice Crooks earlier today. So if anyone would like a summary of the case we are about to hear, if you'd raise your hand, the Deputy Marshal will give you a copy of the summary of this case. Would you raise your hand? Yep. Raise your hand. Yes? Good. I know. I have my summary already, Mr. Cahill. Let me introduce the court to you all. To my immediate left is Justice Crooks, whom you students have met before. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Rogensack, and seated next to her is Justice Michael Gableman. On the far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. With those introductions made, I will turn to calling 09AP661D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Stanton E. Thomas. Arguing on behalf of the Office of Lawyer Regulation is Ronald Lefevre. Mr. Lefevre?
Good afternoon, Chief Justice and Justices. My name is Attorney Ronald Lefevre, and I am retained counsel for the OLR. It's an honor to appear before you and to do so representing the Office of Lawyer Regulation. OLR is appealing from the decision of the referee in this matter. The referee recommended dismissal of the OLR complaint, and therefore the sanction issue was not addressed. OLR is seeking a private reprimand. Complaint of the OLR consists of one count with two violations. OLR asserts that Attorney Stanton Thomas violated SCR 20:4(1)(a)(1), which provides that in the course of representing a client, a lawyer shall not knowingly make a false statement of a material fact or law to a third person, and SCR 20:8(4)(c), which provides that it is professional misconduct for a lawyer to engage in conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation. Also involved is the definition of misrepresentation as set out in SCR 20:10H, which defines misrepresentation as denoting the communication of an untruth, either knowingly or with reckless disregard, whether by statement or omission, which, if accepted, would lead another to believe a condition exists that does not actually exist. This case concerns a communication from Attorney Thomas on behalf of his client, Thomas Ludwig, dated August 10, 2007, in the form of a letter. It's OLR's position that Attorney Thomas knowingly made a false statement of material fact to a third person, not to be confused with a third party, and that Attorney Thomas engaged in conduct involving misrepresentation. The facts of the case are not that complicated and were, for the most part, stipulated between the parties in writing. Additional facts were elicited at the hearing, and various documents were stipulated to and additional documents admitted into evidence. This case is really about the letter that Thomas sent to the accountant named Jeffrey Peterson, who worked for the Clifton Gunderson accounting firm. The letter referenced Crocus Estates, LLC. Peterson does accounting work for Mr. John Ford, who is the managing partner for Crocus Estates, LLC.
Counsel, are you able to give me a little more background of the facts, that is, the partnership, the two fellows were in partnership, Attorney Thomas and Ford, if I recall correctly, and just give me a little bit of context, if you will.
Sure. Backing up, at one point in time, both Mr. Ludwig, who was Attorney Thomas's client, and Mr. John Ford were equal partners in Crocus Estates, LLC. They each owned 100 units in the LLC. And at one point in time, Mr. Ludwig contacted or was involved in a loan with a Mr. Madruski. Madruski was going to lend money to Mr. Ludwig, and as collateral, Mr. Ludwig was going to assign, or did assign, 98 of his units to Madruski as he provided them as collateral on the loan. He assigned two of those units, a 1% interest, to John Ford. John Ford was obligated under the agreement that assigned the interest to Ford by Ludwig to return that interest to Ludwig upon payment in full of the note that was secured by the 98 units. So in other words, Ludwig borrowed money from Madruski and pledged the 98 units. He executed a promissory note to Madruski, and in order to obtain Ford's agreement to this, Ford was assigned to the units until the note was paid in full, and then it was obligated to assign it back.
And the note was paid in full, as I understand it.
It was
marked paid in full.
It was marked paid in full, and it was paid in full by the surrender of the collateral. It was paid in full by a cash payment, as the note originally had stated. And at that point, there's the dispute starts between Ford and Ludwig. Ludwig demanding that, through Attorney Thomas, that Thomas return that, that Ford return the two units, the 1% interest, because the note was paid in full, and Ford consistently denying that he is under any obligation to do so. His attorney, Ford's attorney, also denying that, and so we have. Consistently a dispute here over the ownership interest of this 1%. Eventually it went to a lawsuit in Portage County. And in that lawsuit, the exhibits A and B attached to the complaint were the amendment to the operating agreement where the assignment was made and the copy of the promissory note showing that it was paid in full. Those were the exhibits A and B to the lawsuit in Portage County. That case was dismissed with prejudice, with a reservation of rights on the part of Mr. Ludwig to make claims against Crocus LLC, Crocus Estates LLC, as well as any other individuals other than Ford. Subsequent to that dismissal, which was, I think, February or March of 2005, the dismissal of the lawsuit, we now move ahead in time to August of 2007, August 10, when this letter is sent out. This letter encloses two documents, which are the same documents that were exhibits A and B in the lawsuit. The letter states, is very brief, and states that after indicating that after Attorney Thomas indicates his client hadn't received a Schedule K for the last 2 years, which is a tax form, he stated the ownership interests in Crocus Estates, specifically stating that his client owned the 1% interest. He directed the accountant to see the two documents he enclosed and asked him to please advise. As I indicated, these enclosures were the copy of the amendment to the operating agreement and the copy of the promissory note. In addition to the stated purpose of the letter regarding the Schedule K tax forms, Attorney Thomas also had another purpose in sending this letter, which he testified to, and that was to determine whether or not the information he sought would provide him with a factual basis to file a lawsuit against Crocus and others, except Ford. To cut to the chase, I'd like to just briefly summarize the improper conduct as follows. The purpose of the letter was to cause or convince the accountant, Peterson, to believe that Ludwig, Thomas's client, was in fact an owner of an interest in Crocus. The purpose was also to cause or convince the accountant, Peterson, to rely on that representation of expressed fact in believing that this was the case, and to prompt a response from the accountant based upon a review of the books and records of Crocus.
Mr. Lefevre, yes. Didn't the referee find that it was significant here that this letter ended with please advise? And to my understanding of referee Kim Volpe's determination here, that those words, please advise, showed that indeed the attorney was seeking information but was not attempting to mislead, was trying to find out what the records reflected in terms of ownership of the two units. What's your response to that?
Well, it's true. He did not request any documentation. He requested a response. And as he indicated in his testimony, he expected the accountant to say, yay or nay, there is an interest on the books and records, but that is precisely the information he needed in order to determine whether or not he might have the basis for filing another lawsuit. He didn't need documentation. He only needed to have Peterson look at the books and records and respond from that.
Well, what was wrong with that? You know, is this a misrepresentation situation? Is it an omission situation? But what's the position of OLR?
Well, what's wrong with this? It's not what he's basically making a statement of an untruth here, that his client owns this 1% interest. He'd already filed a lawsuit and dismissed that claim. He bypassed Ford. He didn't contact him intentionally. He said he wouldn't contact Ford because he knew what his response would be. So now he goes to Ford's agent, which is the Clifton Gunderson Law Firm's accountant, to get this information. And he didn't need documentation. When he did need documentation on a prior occasion, he filed a lawsuit over it so he could have the subpoena power. That was the prior lawsuit in Portage County. In this instance, a year and a half has now passed since the filing of this lawsuit. The documentation was provided. Some documentation was provided during the pendency of that litigation in Portage County, which went to Ludwig's financial advisor. There's a letter from Attorney Ray to Attorney Noonan with a copy to Attorney Thomas stating that it's that he's providing copies of the 2003, 4, and 5 income tax returns. Matter of fact, the records that were, even though this lawsuit was against Ford, the records that were provided were Crocus records. So, and you also have a letter from Ford to Thomas stating that he has ensured basically that there is no further interest of Ludwig on the corporate books and records, on the books and records of the LLC. and that he had instructed Clifton Gunnarsson to ensure that this was also reflected in the 03-04 and 05 tax returns. He also stated in that letter that he would not release any further information or documentation unless two conditions were met. It was shortly after that that the lawsuit was filed.
Well, is it that he's pretending that he's asking for innocent information and that he is asking for information that would be damaging
to
someone, and you're asking it to someone's agent? Is that what the problem is?
What it appears here, in view of the fact that Ford stated that his client no longer had an interest on it and was no longer reflected in the income tax returns, to go now to Ford's agent asking if there's anything showing on the books and records, which seemed to be a double check, if you will, on whether or not they actually did what Ford had asked them to do, whether the accountant had followed through.
So is it your position that he should have never been communicating with this guy?
My position is that he intentionally communicated with this guy.
Right, he did. But is it your position he should not have?
That's correct.
And why is that, as his communication, a violation of the code?
Well, let's put it this way. He shouldn't have communicated with him in that form, stating that his client, in unequivocal fact, owned the 1% interest, because the only purpose of making that type of statement was to get the accountant to accept that as a fact and act upon it.
Was there a determination that he did not own 1% interest, or was it just that a lawsuit was dismissed? Because people can dismiss a lawsuit for a lot of different reasons. Maybe they can't afford to go ahead and litigate. Maybe they just have decided life's too short. Maybe they've decided they don't have a claim. Maybe they've decided they can't prove it, but they still might think they have an interest. I'm not sure, and I don't know from the record, and I'm trying to look at what Referee Volke determined. It sure does seem like he didn't know either.
Well, the lawsuit set out the allegations of the promissory note, the collateral, and the assignment, and asked the court to order and adjudicate the fact that Ludwig was a 1% owner, and order that Ford assign back that interest. That case was dismissed with prejudice.
Did the court make the determination that he wasn't a 1% owner, though?
No, the parties stipulated to the dismissal with prejudice.
Right, but was there a to me, those are a little bit parallel to each other. You're asking for a judicial determination on the 1%. You don't get a judicial determination on the 1%, and you don't have a stipulation on the 1%. But for whatever reason, and I'm not sure, but maybe it's in the record somewhere, the lawsuit doesn't proceed. But at least, you know, in practice and as a judge, people dismiss lawsuits for a lot of reasons, necessarily because they think they're wrong.
Attorney Thomas testified that the case was bleeding his client dry, the case that he filed, in effect, and that his client didn't want to pursue it any further once he got the books and records, which apparently Ludwig's financial advisor needed in order to determine whether or not, and here's another fact, whether or not Ludwig would want to repurchase those 98 units back from Madruski. He needed that information and claimed that Ford wasn't providing enough information, so he filed the lawsuit to get subpoena power to have it. Now, the lawsuit on its face states that this 1% interest, it really is Ludwig's, and that Ford should assign it back. Once the information was provided and Ludwig's financial advisor stated or informed Ludwig that this did not make financial sense for him or whatever, for whatever reason, he decided not to pursue the repurchase, then the stipulation was entered into between the parties, and the case was dismissed with prejudice.
So if I've got it right, and I don't want to take up more of your time, but the dismissal, in your mind, means that there's been a determination that he does not have a 1% interest.
Well, it was dismissed with prejudice. So between the two parties to the assignment, which are Ford and Ludwig, the issue is now resolved with a dismissal with prejudice. Neither Ludwig can no longer bring a claim against Ford to have him reassign that interest, if I read the dismissal with prejudice properly between those two parties. Issues
resolved. Follow what you're saying.
Yeah. And the assignment is between Ford and Ludwig. Ludwig assigned to Ford. It's not Ludwig's assignment to Prokus, it's Ludwig's assignment to Fort. So as between the parties, the matter is resolved. So.
What if you're wrong? What if the dismissal with prejudice does not conclusively determine as a matter of law the ownership? Is that a necessary foundation to your charge here?
Well, no, not necessary. The problem with this letter is that this has been disputed from day one. This representation of fact states that my client owns 1%.
And what did Ford believe in that dispute?
Ford believed that Ford didn't testify in this case, but he consistently disputed any claim, and his attorney consistently disputed any claim of an obligation to assign it back.
Is this fair to say that Ford believed that he owned or was entitled to the two units, and that Ludwig believed he owned and was entitled to two units? Is that a fair statement?
Exactly.
So if Ludwig believed he owned the units, and let's say his attorney believed the same, where's the misrepresentation?
Well, Ford also believed he owned the units, and so did his attorney. The matter is, at a minimum, is in dispute. Even if you discount the effect of the lawsuit here, it's a disputed fact. The representation made to Peterson, which, like I say, is made intentionally to Peterson, expresses this as a fact and encloses the same two documents filed in the lawsuit, which substantiate, if you read them, substantiate the statement, my client owns 1%. Now, he's sending this to the agent of the principal. He won't contact the principal because he knows what his answer will be. He's a party. A party will have that knowledge. A third person wouldn't necessarily have the knowledge, although he might, but we're talking about representation made to a third person here. And in effect, what the referee held, the way I view this, is that OLR would have had to prove that Ford was the owner in order for the OLR to prevail in stating that this claim, this representation was false, whereas our position is that the fact that it was disputed is what makes it false. That this representation of fact, Thomas testified this was his opinion. This letter doesn't say anything about an opinion. It expresses a fact. And it's got documentation, selectively, it's got documentation enclosed to substantiate that. But in view of the background and the history on this, the matter is obviously, at the minimum, disputed. It might have been ultimately disposed of in the lawsuit because Ludwig, I believe, certainly can't file another lawsuit asking that the interest be assigned back. So I think the referee... What the referee did, if you want to see what he did, didn't correctly analyze this by stating that OLR didn't prove who owned the interest. What OLR proved is this thing had a history of a dispute, and the representation that was made to this third person doesn't say anything about a dispute. It represents it strictly as an unequivocal fact with supporting documents. There were other documents, of course, he omitted to enclose, which would have been the fact that Ford had said, I'm not providing any further information or documentation, or that Ford had been disputing it. Thomas himself consistently demanded that the interest be assigned back, which is kind of an acknowledgement that it has been assigned. Now he's representing that his client owns that interest. So there was a consistent, and in the lawsuit as well, he wanted the relief he requested is that this interest be assigned back. And I think he knew that it had been assigned and had not been assigned back. The parties had been disputing it consistently. And that, along with the representation made, the representation that this was a fact should have, his representation should have gone further than to just make this a statement of fact. And this is why it's a misrepresentation. There's just an ongoing history behind this. The referee himself determined that he couldn't determine, stated that he couldn't determine who owned the interest.
Mr. Lefevre, that determination by the referee, is that a finding of fact or is that a conclusion of law?
Regarding his determination that he couldn't determine?
Right.
Well, he stated that because he couldn't determine that, he couldn't find a violation. And
the reason I'm asking is because I'm trying to put this in the framework of the standard of review. And quite obviously, if his determination that he couldn't make a finding one way or the other as to who owned the two units, if that's a finding of fact, don't we have to basically accept that?
Well, he said he in his finding, he said, I don't know who to believe.
Okay.
Which still substantiates our position that this unequivocal statement of fact is a misrepresentation because it's disputed. It only proves the point that he doesn't know who to believe as far as the ownership. It proves the point that the representation of this interest as a fact of ownership by Ludwig is what's false about this letter. Not did we prove or did anybody prove who exactly owned that interest. It's a dispute.
Justice Crooks, I think at Appendix 111, it's part of the findings of fact. Then it's also part of the conclusions of law closer to 113, if that helps at all.
Well, I'm concerned, obviously, as to whether or not we look at this de novo or whether or not we give deference to the determination by the referee. And that's why I asked you much earlier whether or not this was an omission situation, a situation where OLR takes the position that the letter should have included the fact of dispute rather than apparently saying, look, we've got these units of ownership, and asking, as I understood the letter, what the corporate records showed. Isn't that the reason why he was writing that letter to Gunderson, to find out what the corporate records showed?
Right. He did not want to go to Ford because he knew what Ford would tell him. Sorry, my red light's on. Do you want me to?
You may finish the question, the answer to the question if you have. Have you answered it fully?
He didn't go to Ford directly because he knew what Ford would say, and he went to the third person, Peterson, with an undisclosed reason for the basis of potentially filing a lawsuit. So that's why he chose to make. That's why I believe he chose to make the representation he did, because if he had indicated there was some type of dispute, Peterson would not have responded.
Thank you, Mr. Lefevre. Mr. Kao, representing Stanton Thomas.
Goes down.
Did you find the?
No.
Okay.
I'll make you.
It's on the left side. Left
side. May it please the court, Richard Kao appearing on behalf of respondent Stanton Thomas, here in person. He's also co-counsel with me in this matter. It's a rare pleasure for me to be appearing on behalf of a respondent. I stole the virtues of an intelligent and measured decision by one of your most experienced referees. And it's a unique and anomalous and unfortunate situation to be here arguing in open court whether Mr. Thomas, a lawyer with a heretofore unblemished record, should be suffer a private reprimand because of his conduct in this case. The fact that he is here is more than a testament to just his grit, but it reflects the integrity that he has, which caused him to refuse to accept private reprimand under these circumstances. He's charged with these instances of misconduct, all stemming from this, I would submit, innocuous letter to these accountants, alleging that he made knowingly made a false statement to a third person, and that he involved himself in dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation. The OLR proved neither. The referee found that I think he found as a matter of fact that the OLR failed to prove that what he stated was false, and also found that he had no intent to deceive anyone in the writing of that letter.
What was the purpose of the letter?
Well, the purpose of the letter was not, as the OLR has suggested, to generate evidence upon which a claim against Crocus could be based, but it was made in the context of exploring the possibilities for recourse for Mr. Ludwig, who in fact owned a percentage of this LLC that was unacknowledged. The OLR really attempted to prove neither of those things, and in fact has retreated and tacitly acknowledged that they haven't proved the falsity of the statement. They say in their brief that that's not their obligation. They need only prove that, nor is it their obligation to prove that he intended to deceive someone. Neither of those can be the law. The language of the rule plainly says what's forbidden is a lawyer making a false statement. The OLR is surely obliged to prove that it's false. They are not, as Mr. Lefevre suggested, required to prove that Mr. Ford was the owner. They were simply required to prove that the statement made by Mr. Thomas was false, and they didn't do that. They didn't try to do that. And the position to which they retreated is this. Well, the proposition stated in that letter was disputed by another person, and they were somehow now obliged under this rule to make that known to the recipient of the statement. Oh, that's a very, very different rule. The rule, as they would suggest it, is a lawyer shall not make a statement with which some other person disagrees without making that disagreement known to the recipient of the statement. I'd venture to say there is no proposition so epistemologically certain or logically invulnerable that I couldn't find someone somewhere who would disagree with it. And I don't think in my advocacy, least of all in my advocacy or in life in general, I need to footnote every declaration I made saying, but other people might disagree. That's what the OLR urges upon you, and it's terribly wrong-minded. And they suggest to you that, of course, this statement would have been trouble-free had he made known that this was his opinion. Well, in fact, he did make known that it was his opinion. Number one, ownership is, of its very nature, I think, a question of mixed question of fact and law, and it is the subject of opinion more than categorical fact. But it was made clear that it was his opinion by the enclosures. I don't understand the inferences that the OLR suggests you draw from those two enclosures. What he said was, my client's the owner. And incidentally, he believed that from day one and believes it to this day, that his client is the owner. And if I might digress, the OLR says that in the lawsuit, he asked that the shares be assigned back. And that is not true. He alleged in the lawsuit that the shares were the property of Mr. Ludwig, his client, and it was a declaratory judgment action seeking a confirmation of that fact then extant and true as of the time he wrote the letter. The significance of the enclosures are this. He says he's the owner and says, see enclosed. What he encloses is not some phony evidence of ownership, not a counterfeit certificate. He encloses the very things upon which his legal reasoning is based, and it's this amendment and the amendment really is kind of the culprit here in terms of the ambiguity that underlies all this, because it's not drafted by a lawyer, it's not drafted by Mr. Thomas, it's drafted by Mr. Ford, and it's very confusing. It says, Mr. Ludwig, by the way, believes he's not assigning ownership at all, that he's assigning voting rights during the pendency of this loan that he's obtained from Mr. Madruski, for which the shares are pledged as collateral. But even if you assume that the assignment was of ownership, it says that upon the debt, the underlying debt to Madruski being paid in full, the shares shall be assigned back to, or the voting rights, either one, are assigned back to Mr. Ludwig. That happened. And so he enclosed both that amendment, that paragraph, and a copy of the note marked paid in full, by means of which he's telling the recipient of that letter, here's my thinking. If he was looking to deceive these people into believing uncritically that Mr. Ludwig was the owner, he wouldn't have enclosed anything. I'm mystified by the inferences that the OLR thinks those enclosures warrant. To my way of thinking, he didn't even need to enclose those, and the statement, he's entitled to have made the statement he made. And I think when pressed, the OLR has said just today that the lawsuit, having been dismissed with prejudice as to Mr. Ford only, somehow constituted a judicial determination that Ford owned the shares. I'm sorry, but that is just clearly not true. I mean, just as Justice Ziegler observed, parties dismiss lawsuits, and in doing so, they don't concede. I was terribly wrong. Mr. Thomas never conceded that. Mr. Ludwig never conceded it. People dismiss lawsuits for the expediency of doing so under the circumstances. And in fact, in this lawsuit, not only did neither Mr. Thomas nor Mr. Ludwig acknowledge that they were wrong and that they weren't the owner, there was a deliberate phrase in the language of the stipulation that said he reserves the right to make the allegations in this lawsuit against any other party. That is to say, the limited partnership itself, perhaps, or anyone else, maybe the accountants for the limited partnership. Incidentally, there was nothing to be obtained as a result of this letter, which really would have had a bearing, one way or the other, on the feasibility of a lawsuit against anyone. I think they were just exploring what are the records of the corporation as maintained by the accountants reflect. Not corporation, limited partnership. Brings up another point. Much is made of the fact that Mr. Thomas bypassed Mr. Ford. Well, he didn't bypass Mr. Ford. Mr. Ludwig was one of the LLC members, and these were accountants for the LLC. They weren't accountants for Mr. Ford. They weren't addressed that way. They were maintaining the records of the LLC. They were the accountants for the LLC, of which Mr. Ludwig was a member. He had every right to go directly to those accountants and say, what do your records reflect with respect to my contention that I'm an owner? The OLR, incidentally, has suggested no real sinister motivation here for Mr. Thomas writing the letter as he did. And incidentally, they refer in their brief to crafting the letter as if this was the blueprint for the invasion of Normandy and was done so deliberately that he's held responsible for every turn of phrase in there or the absence of any qualifier that might otherwise have been put in there. It was anything but. If you look at the letter, there's even a typo in there, or there's a grammatical error. It says, "has recently come to the attention of my attention of my client," and it's not properly worded. And it reflects that this is just a letter that's sent out in an effort to gather information about the circumstance, the result of which wouldn't have really had a bearing one way or another. Had the accountants said, yes, the records of our that we maintain still show him as an owner, well, that wouldn't have constituted a basis for making a claim. It would have been interesting. It might have meant that the instruction by Mr. Ford previously to the accountants to eliminate any reference to Mr. Ludwig's ownership weren't obeyed because they had the gumption and the integrity not to honor that on the basis that Mr. Ford was urging it. But even that really wouldn't have constituted anything but the opinion of someone else about ownership. And so it may have been, you might even think of a sort of an idle undertaking. It certainly was not a sinister one. Another, if I may, the purpose of the lawsuit was not to establish ownership. I mean, there was a request for a declaration that Mr. Ludwig was then the owner. But the real purpose was, and as Mr. Lefevre sort of candidly made known, Mr. Thomas's client, Ludwig, had sold these shares to Majewski, but he had a period of time during which he could repurchase the shares. Mr. Thomas undertook to get information from Mr. Ford about the value of the limited partnership so that Mr. Ludwig could make a decision about whether to exercise those rights. Ford said no, he wouldn't give him anything. The lawsuit was really started as a means of getting that information so that Ludwig could decide whether or not to repurchase the shares from Majewski. And what they learned, finally, it was successful in that respect, that got the information, but what they learned was that limited partnership had been looted, if you will, of one of its major assets. It had been divested and without compensation, and therefore had a value that didn't warrant the repurchase by Ludwig of the units from Majewski. And, correspondingly, didn't have value which justified the pursuit of the lawsuit. I mean, he still had 1% without regard to whether he exercised the rights to repurchase. But that was about 20,000 or thereabouts, I think the estimate was. And it wasn't, by Mr. Ludwig's lights, enough to justify all the time and expense and aggravation of the lawsuit. That's why he dismissed it. Certainly not because he had an epiphany and recognized how wrong he was about his claim of ownership.
Could I ask a question? What is a K-1?
It is a tax form reporting distributions, I believe, of the corporation to its of the LLC to its or a partnership to its participants.
Okay.
I think
if someone is getting a distribution, they would want a K-1. To know how much the distribution was.
I'm not sure if they want it. It's like getting a 1099. I mean, yes, it reflects your income, and it's a document filed with the taxing authorities as well, I believe, like a 1099. So yes, if you received income, you would receive a K-1. You should.
How would a taxpayer know how much to report as a distribution if they didn't have a K-1?
But they might not know, except perhaps by their own records of their having received the money. And at this time, Mr. Ludwig had not received proceeds corresponding with his 1% during the intervening period between this refusal by Ford to honor the reassignment and the time of the lawsuit. So, or of the time of the letter. So, it was probably a fair inference and an assumption on the part of both Mr. Ludwig and Mr. Thomas that the accountants weren't instructed to regard him as a 1% owner. The books didn't reflect that. They'd made neither a distribution of proceeds nor issued a K-1. It brings an interesting point up. In its reply brief, the OLR makes much of the fact that we evidently, in our brief, referred to not the third persons but the third parties. Well, I can tell you and I assure you, we were using those expressions as if synonymous, and I think that's an appropriate interpretation. But in the course of making much of that distinction, the OLR said it would have been okay, perhaps, because parties have notice of the dispute that we say Mr. Thomas had an obligation to reveal to Mr. Ludwig. Well, Clifton Gunderson did have notice of that dispute. We have a letter from Mr. Ford, which long predates the writing of Mr. Thomas's letter, saying, I've instructed the accountants to eliminate any reference to ownership on the part of Mr. Ludwig from the books and records of Crocus Limited Partnership. They had notice of it. They undoubtedly had notice of the dispute that was reflected in the conduct of the lawsuit. The lawsuit preoccupied itself with these records that they maintained, and it's a fair inference and a fair assumption that they did know that this was a disputed proposition. And in fact, when they got the letter from Mr. Thomas, they didn't divulge anything. They went right to their lawyers, and the next thing we know, Mr. Thomas hears from Mr. Ford's lawyers. Actually, I believe the first response was from the lawyers for Clifton Gunderson. It's wrong to refer to Clifton Gunderson as an agent for Mr. Ford. They may have done work for him in other contexts, but in this context, they were the accountants maintaining records on behalf of Procus Limited Partnership, of which Mr. Ludwig was then, and is now, I would submit, a 1% owner.
I think you stated before that Mr. Ludwig was a member of the LLC.
Yes.
But doesn't that depend upon his ownership of 1%?
Yes, yes. As of the time the letter is written, he has clearly divested himself of 98 units, which constituted 49%. Originally, he and Ford are each 50% owners, and Badrewski ends up with 49 of his 50%, and the 1% we would submit upon payment of full of the obligation to Mr. Madruski reverts back to Mr. Thomas. It's an important 1%, of course, because it's a swing vote in any sort of dispute. But bear in mind, the purpose of the assignment, I would submit, is if you're going to do business with someone who I didn't choose to be partners with, I want to have control while that pledge is out there. But when there was an eventual sale, Mr. Ford approved of it, as if to say, well, I'll do business with Mr. Madruski. And when that happened, the 1% went back to Mr. Ludwig.
Let me ask this. Looking at the letter of August 10th, 2007, you make quite a bit of see enclosed and the documents that were enclosed.
Yes.
The referee made quite a bit of please advise.
Yes.
Can anything be made of C.C. Tom Ludwig?
I don't know. I mean, I support both the inferences suggested by the your question, but I don't know. I don't know. This is just Mr. Thomas copying his client on a request for the opinion of these accountants with respect to his ownership. I think that the inferences drawn by the referee with respect to this, to please advise, are appropriate. I say he's an owner, please advise. What do the records reflect?
Had it said that, then OLR probably wouldn't have done anything.
Well, had not by the theory. Oh, I'm sorry, Justice.
Go ahead.
Not by the theory that they've advanced to you. Had he qualified in saying, it's my opinion, or he's an equitable owner, or I take the position.
Or I have some doubts about, or there's a question about.
Yes, I mean, he had no doubts about it, but had he said, it's my position, I think that they probably would have thought, well, that's being candid. But it's wrong-minded. I mean, they spend time in their brief saying an omission, a statement can be rendered false by omission. Well, yes, of course, it can, but it has to be an omission of the kind that renders the statement false. In other words, there's a case where a lawyer says correctly in a divorce context, my client has two children, and the client does have two children, but the client has three children, and so the omission of reference to the third child suggests that, well, he has only two children and not three, and the omission of the reference to the third child does render the statement, minus two children, false.
Suppose Peterson had responded and had a response that was favorable to Mr. Stanton.
Mr. Stanton Thomas.
Could that statement be used against Peterson's client or the other people involved here? Are they trying to trick Peterson into giving a statement that could be used later?
I don't think so. I mean, it might bear marginally on the issue of ownership, but the fact that the records reflect, let's assume the records still reflected, you know, that Ludwig owned 1% and Madruski owned 49% and Ford 50%. And Mr. Ludwig decided, I'm going to sue Crocus now to vindicate my rights as owner of that 1%. I should have had some distributions and so on. Would the fact that it was on the books that way and unaltered constitute proof that was the fact? I don't think so. I mean, it might have sort of borne marginally on that question, but...
Might have been some proof, maybe not conclusive proof.
Yes, right. But even if it was very consequential to have had them respond in a way that Mr. Ludwig might have hoped, he had every right to write to the accountants for the LLC of which he is a member and ask this question. The idea that he bypassed Mr. Ford suggests that these are somehow the minions of Mr. Ford, as truly they were, because they were obedient to his instructions, notwithstanding that the instructions were not justified, and they evidently participate. Well, I don't know if they participated in the divestment of the big asset, but even if it had the promise of revealing very information damaging to Clifton Gunderson itself. Well, I can ask an opponent. I can write to Yamaha and ask whether their cars or Toyota and ask whether their cars are badly built. I don't have to go through their I can't think of an apt analogy, frankly. But it is not so that under these circumstances, Clifton Gunderson can be thought of as the agents of Mr. Ford.
Mr. Kayo, is the objectionable statement is my client is a 1% two-unit owner?
That's the statement I think that the OLR is critical of, but denies the responsibility to prove is false.
What about the statement John Ford is a 50% 100-unit owner?
Well, I guess that's the corollary, I guess, sure, because they might also take the position, no, he was a 51% owner, but they have an obligation then to prove that. They can't just say, look, we come to some different conclusion based on what we think the dismissal of the lawsuit meant, and based on a way we read this amendment or whatever, and therefore, you know. It's subject to criticism. They have an obligation to prove that it's false. I mean, the rule says a lawyer shall not knowingly make a false statement of fact or law to a third person. Well, they have to show it's false, and they deny even responsibility for doing that. It's wrong-minded. And in fact, I think we would all be in trouble. If all we had to do in making declarations, and there's been a lot of declarations here today, and without trying to be cute about it, I mean, there's been declarations by the lawyer for the OLR with which I disagree, and some of which I've made known. And there was no footnoting in the declarations to this court that saying, well, you know, I believe that's true, but I think KO disagrees. And of course, we'd be paralyzed if we were obliged to do that. The other question is, even if the second finding of referee Volkey, that there was no intent to deceive, is really rendered moot by his first finding, that they failed to prove in either instance an essential element of the complaint. But it's certainly a truly unassailable finding on this record. There is no motive for Mr. Thomas to have intended to misrepresent. Referee Volkey heard the testimony of Mr. Thomas and said he has no intent to deceive. The OLR has said to you there is no component, there is no requirement that we show that we show a deliberate or intention to deceive. And it's true. It's not in the rule. And the existence of an element like that is uncomfortable and a little cumbersome for the OLR in wielding its power. But we don't prosecute mistaken, innocent misstatements of fact. I mean, surely You know, Mr. The OLR has said today that the lawsuit sought the court requiring the assignment back from Mr. Ford to Mr. Ludwig, the 1%. Well, that's inaccurate. The lawsuit said that he was the owner and asked for a declaratory judgment so confirming. That's a fine point. And, of course, no one's going to accuse anyone of misrepresentation, least of all misrepresentation, that should be the basis for a complaint of misconduct against a lawyer with an otherwise unblemished career. And I would venture to say every minute of every business hour, there are lawyers innocently making statements of fact that are wrong. I mean, if I said it's wonderful to be here in front of you on this beautiful Wednesday afternoon,
you'd be right.
Time goes slowly, but when you're standing here, I can assure you. But no one would prosecute me, notwithstanding that I made a misstatement of fact, unless I had some reason to do it, and someone came to the conclusion that I did it on purpose. The referee urges you to dismiss this complaint, and it is really the only suitable outcome here. I mean, it is a pleasure to be here as a respondent, but this case comes with the...
Really mean it now?
Pleasure is no, that's a lie. That's a lie. Pleasure is overstated. But I will say, it comes with that unique burden of representing someone who is truly blameless. And I don't know that I've ever been able to be in front of this court with the measure of rectitude and that I have associated with this case, or that I've had the pleasure of representing a lawyer who I so admire and who has had the integrity to not capitulate. I have had dozens and dozens and dozens of clients, I would venture to say 100 over the course of my career, choke down a private reprimand and acknowledge wrongdoing rather than endure what Mr. Thomas has endured, tens of thousands of dollars of expense and public notice and so on, rather than accept the expediency of a private reprimand. And he hasn't done that. It should mean something, and I admire him for doing it. And I hope you'll take your referee's advice and dismiss this lawsuit.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Kayo? Thank you. There are no further questions. Mr. Lefevre?
Well, I've heard some interesting comments here. Basically, third persons and third and parties are the same. They should be treated the same. That's not what the rule says. The rule specifically refers to statements made to third persons. They are not expected to know, and maybe in this case, the account might have been familiar. I don't know. That's not in the record. But the point is, this was directed specifically to the accountant. This is not to Ford. The reason for this, one of the reasons testified to by Attorney Thomas, was to determine whether or not there would be a factual basis for the filing of another lawsuit against Crocus, as it was reserved in the lawsuit against Crocus or others except Ford. That was a question I asked him, in which he answered in the affirmative. That was not disclosed in the letter that he sent to Peterson. The enclosures to this letter were the exact same two that were attached to the lawsuit, which was dismissed. The comment was made that deceit is not an element of the rule. Deceit is one of the elements in 20:84C, but it's not the same as misrepresentation. Now, there can be deceitful omission, and omitting to inform Peterson of something else besides the unequivocal ownership of the 1% interest.
Mr. Lefevre, Mr. Kayo says, and he has a very good point, that that his client could have made life a heck of a lot easier for himself by just swallowing it, saying, okay, I'll take a private reprimand. No one is going to know. It's going to be on my record for X number of weeks, years, months, or whatever at the... OLR, and that, no, he's not going to really submit and not going to do this kind of agreement. So my question is the same, but he's a man of principle, and I can understand that. OLR has really one count, two factual issues, so factual bases, and a private reprimand. Why is it here? Is it a matter of principle?
No, the conduct itself in making this representation, this is a misrepresentation. It's an attempt to communicate.
No, but OLR is a busy agency. It's a lot of business, a lot of work, has limited funds, might recover funds from Mr. Thomas, might not, has other cases that have to be prosecuted and brought through. Why is it moving forward for a private reprimand? Why doesn't it say it's not worth our time for a private reprimand?
I don't have an answer to that as far as why a decision might be made in terms of the present budget within the OLR, but...
Whose decision is it to move forward and appeal? Yours? Did you try this?
Yes, I did.
Is it yours or is it OLR's?
Well, OLR's. The PRC issued its decision and then the matter was referred to me for handling.
And then to go forward on appeals, that your decision or OLR's?
OLR's.
Okay.
So I don't really have the answer for your question.
All right.
What? This is not a mistaken, innocent statement of fact. And the reason I say this is because it's directed to Peterson. When Attorney Thomas wanted financial information on a previous occasion, he filed a lawsuit to get subpoena power in order to get information as well as documentation. Here he's not asking for documentation. He's asking the accountant to please respond, but he's asking the accountant to respond from the books and records of Crocus. And this is a year and a half later. This is a year and a half after the lawsuit was dismissed with prejudice. And as Attorney Thomas testified, when I asked him whether or not he attempted to contact Mr. Ford, he stated he already knew what Ford would tell him, that he owned the 1% interest and that his client had no interest in Crocus. So I guess we can try to... figure out why the correspondence is sent to Peterson, if that's the case. But this falls squarely within the elements of a misrepresentation because, oh, I see my light's on.
You may finish the sentence.
Misrepresentation that it was an attempt to convince Peterson, a third person, to accept this ownership, issue of ownership as true and not only just to accept it, but to act upon it.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Akeo, and thank you, Mr. Lefevre, for your arguments in OLR versus Stanton Thomas 09 AP 661D. This concludes our arguments for the March calendar. The court is adjourned until oral argument on the April calendar. The court will meet in the conference room in closed session at 3 o'clock.